This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Supposedly a comic version of Canticle for Leibowitz, which if it gets done, it'll be a lot of fun.
You've been listening to an interview with Terry Bisson, whose latest novel is Any Day Now. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. For more information about this show, go to bookwaves.com, where you'll also find an extended version of this interview. Bookwaves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.
Radio is a proud media sponsor of the 28th annual Martin Luther King Day event. Keep Alive the Dream, an annual tribute to Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., produced by the World Arts Foundation. This year's event will take place at the New Beginnings Conference Center, 3300 Northeast 172nd Place in Portland. KBOO will again broadcast the annual celebration in its entirety. More information about this live broadcast can be found at kboo.fm/2013MLK.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub, independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizza, salads, and wraps. Located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, 503-232-5511 or laurelhursttheater.com.
It's time for another edition of 100 Tacks on KBOO. Here's your host, Andrew Weymouth.
Welcome to Bookwaves. I'm Richard Walensky.
W-H-E-R-R-Y. A wherry is the name for a conventional workboat used by the Thames River watermen, traditionally a sculling boat. It was the name of the vessel being used by two gentlemen rowing on the Willamette from a photograph taken in 1902. They were members of one of the oldest rowing clubhouses west of the Mississippi, the Portland Rowing Club. Hello, my name is Andrew Weymouth, and this is 100 Tacks. This episode is on the docking foundation of the Rock Island Clubhouse. Elk Rock Island is about 6 miles south of Portland on the Willamette River. The craggy rocks at the base lead up to high, wavering grass and then to madrona trees, occasionally holding a rough-winged swallow or two. The island is reachable by foot when the tide is low enough, which is likely how Lot Whitcomb, the original owner of the island, stumbled upon it. Whitcomb was also the founder of Milwaukee, Oregon, the neighbor city to Elk Rock Island. His wife, titled in the deed as Queen V. Whitcomb, sold the island to a fellow named Hagenberger, who sold it to a fellow named Fisher, who sold it to a successful businessman from Portland named Axel Reffling for $1,500 in 1892, which was subsequently taken from him by the county sheriff for delinquent taxes and put up for auction by the state. The winning bidder at the auction was a gentleman only identified as Mr. Marley, who purchased the entire property for $9.95. Axel Reffling quickly bought back the island from Mr. Marley for an undisclosed amount, but something tells me it was quite a bit higher than $9.95. June 30th, 1901, the Morning Oregonian. A proposition is underfoot to organize an outing club on Elk Rock Island with a caterer, a dancing platform, and a bathhouse.
My name is Enid Briggs. I've lived in Milwaukee for 87 years. And I was born
Sisters
here,
Adele Wilder and Enid Briggs are great. They are the current operators of the Milwaukee Historical Society in Milwaukee, Oregon. It's a small building right next to the train tracks.
Well, we just stop talking when it goes by and then it's gone. Yeah. Rattles the shelves a little.
I talked with Enid Briggs and her cousin Don McLaughlin in the kitchen of the Milwaukee Historical Society. The first time that I visited, Adele and her sister led me through the first floor of the old house all the way to the kitchen, where they had a folding chair and a green vinyl card playing table that had a great big folder on top of it, labeled Elk Rock Island. On May 3rd, 1879, the Portland Rowing Club is established. Their boathouse was located at the foot of Southeast Ivan Street. Despite plenty of concern over the cleanliness of the Willamette River, Portland has always been a big rowing town. The river is calm enough that one can row up or downstream with relative ease. Rowing is easily one of the best vantage points to have if you are interested in the history of a city. The city begins on the water and grows outward. From a kayak or canoe, all of the industrial bones are visible. I pulled up to the bank next to Southeast Ivan Street. The old Portland Rowing Club structure is completely gone. In fact, the Portland Rowing Club itself is now the Portland Boat Club, and their current boathouse is now in far north Portland. All that remains of the lot is a shallow push-off point in the river next to a massive cement factory. At the Portland City Archives, I was able to find the first few correspondences between the Portland Rowing Club and Axel Reffling, starting around 1901, seeing if they might be able to construct their clubhouse on his island. But more than likely, the rowing club required more money than they had in their numbers, so they formed a collection of Portland athletic clubs called the Island Outing Club. A handsome clubhouse for summer use is being completed on an island in the Willamette. It is now more than 500 members, and it numbers among those some of the most prominent commercial businessmen in the city. The Rock Island Club was formally opened on June 20th, 1906. A gay party enjoyed dancing at the Rock Island Club last night. The club is one of the prettiest spots on the Willamette and is accessible by car or launches. The broad verandas and open hall make an ideal place to dine. Mrs. Gay Lombard, whose entertainments are invariably perfect in every detail, was hostess of a bridge party, which she gave at the Rock Island Club. Mr. and Mrs. H.E. Judge have anchored their houseboat, Tic Tac, for the summer. If the society section in the Morning Oregonian was any indicator, the clubhouse became an instantly popular attraction. It was where the elite held dinners, attended important statewide meetings, and relaxed with their families. The structure of the clubhouse was well suited for it. The best pictures that I've seen of the club I found in a Morning Oregonian from September 2nd, 1906. It was a full-page spread on the newly opened establishment. The structure was 80 feet wide and 130 feet long, white, wooden, and standing two stories high. The space limitations due to the terrain of the island were counterbalanced by a veranda that wrapped itself nearly 360 degrees around the second story of the building, allowing guests to dine looking out either on the Willamette or into the tangle of Elk Rock Island's flora and fauna from the back. If one were scanning left to right over the scene, to the very left of the picture you would see a series of houseboats that were moored along the northwest side of the island. Then you would see the Rock Island Club with its long, grand stairway. Then, off to the right, much less glamorous, is a smaller stairway slapped onto the side of the building. This is the only remaining structure of the Rock Island Clubhouse. Peter Kerr came from Scotland in 1888 for one purpose alone, business. He came from working in the grain importation game in Great Britain and scouted out areas in Australia, New Zealand, and Argentina before deciding Portland would be the most appropriate place for his future grain exportation company, Jebson & Kerr. In addition to marrying an Oregonian in 1905, he grew his roots even further into the Portland soil by becoming a member of the Rock Island Club. Reading the full list of members from 1908 is a bit like reading a Portland street map. J.W. Ladd, R.W. Hoyt, Gay Lombard, R.L. Gleason, J.C. Ainsworth, and E.J. Failing. But it seems like that very exclusive list of names were getting a little bristled by the level of popularity that the clubhouse was achieving. The Rock Island Clubhouse, which has been owned by Mr. Reffling, will probably pass out of his hands. Their plan is to form a club of 250 members and buy the place outright. If the plan is carried out, the clubhouse will be enlarged and converted into a summer hotel for members only. The Morning Oregonian, September 15th, 1907. By 1910, the island was owned by Kerr himself. The twilight years of the Rock Island Clubhouse appear to be a sleepy contrast to its sexy society page heyday, quietly winding its way through the golden years until one day in 1916 when it burst into flames. Rock Island Club burns. Two women narrowly escaped death, and damage estimated at $25,000 was done when fire fanned from a stiff breeze from downriver swept over Rock Island late today and destroyed the big clubhouse. The blaze was caused by an overheated flue. The property was owned by the Portland Rowing Club, who ran it as a summer resort. The loss was not covered by insurance.
Save for a Peter Pan-like burglar that lived on the island in a tent in 1920 and the open picnics that Peter Kerr held annually, life on the island after the fire was lived mainly by the swallows and the madrona trees. Peter Kerr sold the island to Portland Parks and Recreation in 1941, already with edicts in place ensuring Elk Rock Island's natural reserves remain intact. Quote, not to be used for immoral purposes, no factory, mill, construction work, or any other mercantile or business use, unquote. This again is Don McLaughlin.
The island is just a piece of rock with a lot of growth on it.
It was a volcano.
The island was?
Yes.
Okay.
Peter Kerr's work in conserving the island can't be overstated in this story. Because, listener, I've been holding out on one incredible fact concerning Elk Rock Island. Elk Rock Island is a gigantic volcanic mountain that is as large as the towering Mount Hood and millions of years older. It is older than the primeval Hawaiian volcanic mountains, nearly 40 million years young. Over thousands of years, the land sediment surrounding Elk Rock has slowly filled up around the mountain, burying it until only the very tip remains above ground. The Willamette River rose up alongside the mountain to form an island as we recognize it today. I can't suppress my amazement while I'm walking around the island, past the casual Milwaukeeans taking their dogs for a stroll, past the stone teenage explorers and the weekend boating enthusiasts, that at that very moment, we are all walking on the hump of a gigantic buried dinosaur. And this immediately makes me think of Mr. Marley at the county auction in 1899 again, after the island had been taken from Axel Reffling for not paying his taxes, who bought this geological anomaly for $9.95. Mr. Marley's luck at that moment may have been the dumbest in recent history. Thank you to Adele, Enid, and Don at the Milwaukee Historical Society, Mary B. Hansen at the Portland City Archives, the Portland Boat Club, Alder Creek Rentals, KBOO Radio, and the Milwaukee House of Records. Please check out 100 Tacks on Tumblr to see a bunch of pictures related to this story and let me know what you think of the show. The music that you heard was created by Piano Tape. My name is Andrew Weymouth, and you have been listening to 100 Tacks.
And finally, this morning on KBOO, we hear an excerpt from a recent talk by Sut Jolly, who spoke at the Rethinking Marxism Conference held at the University of Massachusetts and organized by the journal Rethinking Marxism. Sut Jolly is a filmmaker, author, and professor of communications at the University of Massachusetts. His talk was part of a panel on the power of left media.
Despite the power of corporate media, the left media in the United States, and I'm going to restrict my comments, sorry, Liza, to the US, has never been more lively and has never been more vibrant. And in what follows, I'm going to do a sort of quick cover the current state of left media, and I'm going to leave out a lot of important examples, and that's only for the benefit of time. And I understand that, I hope you'll understand that doesn't mean I don't value those things that I don't name. So what is the state of left media, or actually the term that I prefer, of independent media? Well, in the traditional print media, there has been, of course, a long history of alternative voices and views. The Nation is the most prominent of these, and I'm glad to see that it's growing. And there are a number of other magazines and journals, for example, The Progressive, Z Magazine, In These Times, that have a relatively large national reach. Radio has also been a medium where there has been a progressive presence, especially at the local level with thousands of low-power community stations around the country, sometimes linked together in national network through the Pacifica network. I want to draw special attention to the work of David Barsamian and Alternative Radio in providing programming for this loose network of stations. And just as an aside, David Barsamian has sometimes taped my speeches, and I know exactly when they're broadcast around the country, because immediately they are, I get a flurry of emails from a very particular place, a very particular regional location, and they come, they're actually all over the place, which means that these local radio stations are, in fact, getting out a lot of content. Added to these developments in the last 10 years have been very important developments in television and video. Through satellite, both Link TV and Free Speech TV have provided an outlet for the screening of programming that cannot, by definition, find its way onto the screens of the corporate media. And both those outlets, both Link TV and Free Speech TV, need much more support from the rest of us. I also want to mention Deep Dish TV and Dee Dee Hallock, who for at least the last two decades have been committed to producing video programming that challenges in fundamental ways the status quo. But of course, the major innovations in left media have been made possible by the internet revolution. With publishing costs and production costs substantially cut, there is now a veritable explosion of progressive content. There is now more of it than ever before, and there is almost immediate access to it. And in fact, I think what is most important about the internet phenomena is the speed at which it occurs. It allows us to understand what is going on much faster than the past, and it allows us to respond to events on an immediate basis. Gone are the days when you have to wait for the nation to come through your mailbox before you could figure out what your position was on a particular thing. And the internet now allows writers and journalists from all over the world to respond instantly to breaking local events. Okay, when Israel's war against Lebanon began, you could understand it very quickly by going to a number of internet sites and by getting analysis from the region, from experts in the region itself. And as long as we know that the corporate media will not tell you everything you need to know, that's an important caveat. If you know the corporate media will not tell you what you need to know, then we currently have, at a relatively cheap cost, instant access to the most advanced political analysis. And I can't stress this point too much. We have lived through an information revolution on the left. And the one program that kind of brings all this all together is in a progressive version of Synergy. Amy Goodman's program, Democracy Now!, utilizes radio, internet, and television to provide the best journalism available anywhere. It is the first genuinely national and international daily show, not the daily show, a daily show, to emerge from the independent media sector. If you take all this together, print, radio, TV, internet, I think it is correct to say that the independent media has never been more vibrant and more capable of reaching so many people than at the present time. And that left media, the independent media, has sustained us ideologically and politically at a very bleak time for the left. And I think that's a very, very important function. We need to be sustained internally as well. And at one level, this is a new